Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Sunday, April 12th, and this is our Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition, packed as always. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex, and we're thrilled to be back with you. Honestly, sometimes I feel like we're tuning a piano with 88 keys, each representing a new factor influencing the global landscape. And right now, a lot of those keys are slightly out of pitch.
That's putting it mildly. We're starting with global instability. Did you know that sovereign debt reaching distressed levels is now higher than at any point since 2009? We'll unpack what that means for resilient investing.
And it's not just debt. The energy markets are a huge piece of this, particularly as macroeconomic policy attempts to thread the needle between inflation and growth.
And then it's full-on AI takeover. Corporate investment is surging, but are we even beginning to understand the systemic risk? I still think you're being too optimistic about the regulation.
Oh, that's a challenge. But honestly, it's what keeps things interesting, isn't it? We'll be digging into all of that and more over the next hour. Let's dive in.
Jamie Dimon is calling private credit a slow bank run. That's direct. Let's talk about navigating this mess, building portfolios that won't unravel when the geopolitical world inevitably gets weirder.
It's a stark framing, certainly, but I think it reflects a growing recognition that the last decade of relatively benign market conditions has lulled investors into a false sense of security. We're entering a period Matthew McLennan frames as a bipolar hegemonic standoff, and that requires a fundamental shift in how we think about risk.
A bipolar hegemonic standoff. That sounds expensive. So less diversification and more what? He keeps using the word variegation. Is that just a fancy way of saying don't put all your eggs in one basket?
It's a deliberate distinction. Diversification often creates statistical illusions of safety, concentrating risk within the overall market, the late 90s tech bubble being a prime example, as McLennan notes, or the current dominance of US equities. Variegation is about intentional non-uniformity, cultivating a diverse ecosystem of exposures based on scarcity value, rather than simply spreading capital around.
Scarcity. Okay. So find things that are hard to get and hope everyone else wants them too. That feels optimistic.
It's less about hope and more about acknowledging fundamental realities. McLennan emphasizes investing in companies with strong market position, free cash flow generation, and the ability to consolidate their position during challenging times, eclectic royalties, or becoming a toll collector in niche markets. These businesses aren't relying on decades of forecasted growth. They're selling things people need, not just things people want.
Toll collectors. I like that. Like indispensable infrastructure. Not the next AI unicorn.
So here's the picture. Critically, these businesses need a valuation margin of safety. Overpaying for growth is a recipe for disaster, especially in a volatile environment. First Eagle's approach, as highlighted by McLennan, aligns with Warren Buffett's current thinking, identifying companies selling products that are demanded by the citizenry. Adaptability is key.
Products people demand. So less Peloton, more Procter & Gamble.
In a simplified sense, yes. Though it's more nuanced than that. It's about resilient demand, even if earnings fluctuate. Think about it this way. The process of distilling a fine whiskey involves selecting the best ingredients, carefully controlling the fermentation, and patiently allowing the spirit to mature. Global instability and resilient investing is similar. You're selecting for quality assets, enduring turbulent conditions, and allowing compounding to work over the long term.
A whiskey metaphor. Bold choice. Okay, so we're building a portfolio of incredibly boring but necessary companies. What about the stuff that actually moves the market? Geopolitics, AI, crypto.
Those are the shocks we need to prepare for and where variegation becomes crucial. Cash and gold serve as ballast, offering protection against purchasing power erosion. Gold in particular, McLennan reframes not as a commodity but as defensive land, a scarce mobile store of value defying conventional financial theory.
Defensive land. I'm picturing Fort Knox but portable.
Consider this, he argues it's more secure than treasury bills due to its limited supply. This concept of fixed positional assets versus fixed principal assets is core to his framework. It's about recognizing that scarcity trumps liquidity in a crisis. The fate of entire countries can hinge on random actions. As McLennan observed with Churchill in WWAI, predictability is an illusion.
So gold isn't just shiny, it's strategically sound. That's a new pitch for my mother-in-law.
Strategically sound and a hedge against the inherent agency costs of fiat money. McLennan points out that fiat systems are systematically biased towards expansionary policies, eventually leading to dilution or collapse. Gold provides a degree of insulation from that systemic risk.
Agency costs, meaning governments can't help themselves from printing money.
The implication runs deeper. That creates a long-term structural headwind for any asset denominated in fiat currency. This is why a defensive allocation to gold, 20 to 25% in First Eagle's model, is so critical.
Okay, gold, boring companies, and a healthy dose of skepticism. What about all the hypes? AI, for example. Are we missing out on the next big thing by being so cautious?
McLennan advocates for identifying prime numbers among thousands of companies, those with scarce market positions, rather than chasing popular AI beneficiaries. He's skeptical that the most exciting AI companies are reasonably valued at this point. It requires patience to find opportunities.
Prime numbers. So the stuff everyone overlooks because it's not flashy enough.
Two things stand out. And it's not just AI. The Ukraine conflict, the tensions in Iran, these are all shocks that create opportunities for patient investors. The 1970s offer a historical parallel. Both periods saw fiscal deficits rising from prior booms, laying the groundwork for inflation.
Deja vu all over again. So what's different this time?
McLennan constructively points out that our current lower energy dependence makes sensitivity potentially less acute, though still relevant. And importantly, he stresses that successful investments accrue benefits over a decade or more.
A decade? That's a long time to wait for a payoff. Most investors are wired for the annual cycle, not the decadal one.
He frames investing as less about prediction and more about open-mindedness to a broader range of outcomes than expected. Building a portfolio structure built for endurance and resilience, a business gardener preparing for various seasons and hazards.
A business gardener. I'm starting to see a theme here. Lots of metaphors for slow, deliberate action.
It's about recognizing that the act of seeking value can erode opportunities. Much like the snow leopard metaphor, the value lies in the integrity of the process, not necessarily in achieving a specific outcome. Patience and acceptance of uncertainty are paramount.
So less hot money, more long-term tending. What does this actually look like in practice? Specific examples.
First Eagle's team-level diversification strategy is a good starting point. Individual specialization within a variegation framework creates an additional layer of risk management, enabling concentrated bets at the individual level while mitigating overall portfolio risk. They're building an ecosystem of expertise.
An internal hedge fund, basically.
It's more sophisticated than that. The eclectic royalties framework, building a portfolio of businesses that capture a small but essential share of economic activity, offers a highly specific strategic takeaway. Christian Heck's insight that owning companies people can't do without historically performs well, even during WWAI, illustrates the power of defensive positioning.
Companies people can't do without. Like food producers. Utilities.
Those are good examples. But it's also about finding toll collectors, identifying consistent cash flow generation within a niche, waiting for exogenous events to create valuation opportunities. It's a long-term game. And it's not about being right all the time.
Easier said than done, especially when everyone's screaming about AI and geopolitical risk.
That's where humility comes in. McLennan argues that humility is a condition precedent to finding undervalued assets. A lack of humility leads to overpaying based on subjective future predictions. Fred Martin's adage, there are two types of investor, humble investors and investors who are about to be humbled, is relevant here.
Oh, that's a pretty harsh assessment of most of Wall Street.
It is.
And that's why a focus on quality, scarcity, and intentional non-uniformity is so crucial. It's about building a portfolio that can withstand varied shocks and deliver long-term returns, even if it means missing out on some short-term gains.
Okay, so the takeaway is slow down, focus on fundamentals, embrace boring, and accept that you're probably wrong about everything.
In essence, yes. Global instability and resilient investing requires a long-term perspective, a willingness to wait, and a commitment to sensible capital allocation. It's about building a portfolio that's designed to survive, not to speculate.
So we're building portfolios for a world that's actively trying to disprove our assumptions. That's refreshingly realistic. 1/6 of global oil production is currently constrained. Let's just start there. That's not a rounding error, that's a systemic shock. Today, we're unpacking energy markets and macroeconomic policy, and whether central banks are even equipped to handle what's coming.
That figure from Sheets underscores the magnitude of the disruption. It's not simply about price, it's about the availability of the fundamental input for nearly all economic activity and the potential for second-order effects that are far-reaching and haven't been fully priced in. The question becomes, how do we untangle the interplay between these energy shocks, inflation expectations, and the increasingly reactive and potentially misdirected central bank responses?
Misdirected feels polite. We're hearing a lot about a potential recession, but Muir is adamant it's not oil prices causing it, but central banks reacting to them. That's a critical distinction.
He's right to emphasize that. It's a cascade effect. Rising oil prices, acting as a consumer tax as Muir points out, increase inflationary pressures, forcing central bank tightening, which then slows growth, potentially triggering the recession. However, it's the monetary response, the attempt to suppress demand, that's the primary driver, not the supply shock itself. This is particularly concerning in Europe, which he highlighted as a mispriced market.
Mispriced because they're more vulnerable. They're net energy importers, so the consumer tax is larger, the central bank reaction is stronger. Simple enough. But isn't the Fed supposed to be data dependent? Shouldn't they see this coming?
The data is ambiguous. While energy prices are undeniably rising, Sheets notes U.S. earnings estimates are still trending upward. The Fed staff models, interestingly, predict a minimal impact of energy shocks to core inflation, a divergence from other models, as noted in the Bloomberg Surveillance TV segment. That highlights the inherent uncertainty driving their decision-making process.
Minimal impact. So they're looking at headline inflation, ignoring the regressive tax on everyone earning under $50,000, as Steiner pointed out. That feels optimistic.
It's a simplification, certainly. The shift to net exporter status has bifurcated the impact. The energy sector benefits enormously, while lower-income earners bear the brunt of the price increases. The question is whether the earnings gains within the sector can offset the reduced spending elsewhere, and that's currently being tested.
And that brings us to fiscal policy. Because if the earnings gains are concentrated and the Fed is reacting to the wrong signal, Muir's point that fiscal policy is now more important than monetary policy seems, less contrarian and more obvious.
Worth noting, monetary policy operates on the demand side, but energy shocks are inherently a supply-side issue. Fiscal policy can directly address the supply constraints, or as we've seen historically, exacerbate them. Consider the Korean capital gains tax change in December 2023. It triggered a mass exodus from foreign assets, including Bitcoin and U.S. stocks, as investors repatriated capital, creating one-sided pressure. That's fiscal policy warping markets.
And the pattern may repeat in Japan and China. Capital controls, directed savings, government subtly deciding where the money goes. It's not a free market anymore, it's a directed economy with interest rates as side effects.
Stepping back, the French life insurance policies directing savings into government bonds, a mechanism to artificially create demand, as Gave highlighted, is a prime example. It distorts market signals and effectively turns savings vehicles into bond financing mechanisms. This reduces the effectiveness of monetary policy.
So the Fed's trying to steer a boat with a broken rudder while someone else is changing the ocean currents. Lovely. But what about bond markets? We're seeing this weird decoupling between oil prices and yields, Muir flagged.
That's a key observation. Traditionally, rising oil prices would push yields higher due to inflation expectations. The recent decoupling suggests the market is increasingly anticipating the economic slowdown associated with higher energy costs, lessening the immediate impact on bond yields. It's a complex signal.
A complex signal that's probably masking pain in private credit because tightening spreads feel wrong. They don't reflect a recessionary environment.
Agreed.
The high-yield market is a poor proxy for assessing credit risk, specifically in the private credit space. The shift to direct lending, dominated by higher-quality borrowers, is masking the potential problems elsewhere. Steiner details embedded loss content and deteriorating underwriting standards. Liquidity is declining, and there's a worry of QE happening under the covers.
Speaking of masks, what about China? Their bond market is the only major one delivering returns since the start of the war. That's weird.
It suggests a fundamentally different economic management philosophy, prioritizing bond investor benefit. The government seems to be actively supporting its bond market, unlike Western economies, which have been detrimental to bondholders. The divergence is stark.
And then there's Trump. Because everything with Trump is a performance. His rhetoric, the tariffs, the threats, Muir thinks it's strategically designed to create the conditions that justify interventionist policies.
It's an Nixonian approach, creating market stress to justify price controls and export restrictions. It's a fucked up, you trusted us dynamic, as Gave put it, eroding the reliability of safeguards like the transferability of bonds to commodities in the U.S. as a consistent supporter of the global trading system. He's weaponizing economic uncertainty.
So he creates the problem, then offers the solution, which is further intervention. Brilliant if terrifying. And that, of course, leads us back to energy stocks. They're the best performing sector over multiple timeframes, despite limited broad ownership.
Sarasna correctly identifies a structural bull market driven by long-term geopolitical shifts and the need for diversified supply. However, that success also creates a vulnerability. The risk of interventionist policies, taxes on profits, export bans increases as the trade becomes too popular.
Because governments don't like letting anyone make too much money. It upsets the balance. But realistically, what's the worst case scenario?
Supply disruptions. The shipping bottlenecks, as Muir points out, take time to resolve, 1 week to clear for each day of disruption. Even a swift reopening of the Strait of Hormuz won't quickly fix the issues. This creates a lag effect, prolonging inflationary pressures.
So a prolonged period of high prices, forcing central bank responses, potentially leading to recession, and all while governments are subtly directing capital flows. That's fun. What about the dollar?
Shorting the dollar, as Gabe suggests, is potentially safer than shorting bonds. Governments are likely to embrace capital controls or fiscal policies to suppress rates, prioritizing preventing rising yields over maintaining currency stability. The willingness to sacrifice the dollar's value is greater than the willingness to allow yields to rise significantly.
Which, let's be honest, is a fairly alarming admission. But what about AI? Because we've been talking about macro forces, geopolitical shifts, but AI is fundamentally changing the calculations.
It's a critical variable. The U.S. energy market's shift to net exporter status creates a bifurcated impact, with the regressive tax on lower-income earners masked by energy company gains. But that's happening against a backdrop of rapidly accelerating productivity gains driven by AI. It's a paradoxical situation where the underlying economy is becoming more efficient while the consumer experience is deteriorating.
And that's where the Fed gets really confused. They're looking at GDP growth, 1% higher as noted, but ignoring the 2 to 3 times higher budget deficits. They're focusing on the surface, not the cracks beneath. Honestly, I don't know how this plays out. The level of intervention, the geopolitical instability, the capital controls, it feels like we're entering a period of extreme uncertainty.
I agree. The assumptions underpinning global finance have eroded, and the traditional safeguards are no longer reliable. This creates a situation where predicting outcomes is exceptionally difficult. The dynamic in the Middle East is particularly volatile, and the potential for asymmetric warfare, as Steiner points out, could escalate rapidly. The fact that the market is already pricing in oil's impact, creating a challenging trading environment, as Muir notes, means that identifying meaningful deviations from expectations will be exceptionally difficult. It's less about predicting the direction and more about anticipating the unintended consequences. And that's a very unsettling place to be.
Something to flag here, because if you try to predict the direction, you're just guessing. But if you focus on the unintended consequences of this policy maze, the shift in the labor-to-capital relationship, the restructuring of enterprise infrastructure, the vulnerabilities arising from decentralized code creation, that's where we might find opportunity. And it all hinges on whether the AI revolution will exacerbate or offset these macro forces, which is exactly what we'll dive into next. So apparently, a significant number of employees are sabotaging their company's AI initiatives. 29% admit to it, 44% among Gen Z. That feels less like a tech disruption and more like a really awkward office prank war. We're talking about the AI revolution, specifically the corporate investment side and the systemic risks that are bubbling up.
It's a crucial data point that highlights the disconnect between leadership enthusiasm and workforce reality, and directly ties into systemic risk. The $93 billion imbalance in spending, 93% infrastructure, 7% human support, isn't just inefficient, it's creating deliberate friction. If employees don't trust the tools or aren't equipped to use them, the ROI on those investments becomes incredibly fragile.
Fragile is generous. More for show, 75% of executives say about their AI strategy. That's a lot of expensive theater. But the article also suggests this isn't solely about AI, it's about a fundamental shift in income distribution since 1980, with profits accruing to owners. So are we seeing massive AI spending as a way to further solidify that trend?
That's a key insight. It reframes the narrative. The surge in capital expenditure isn't necessarily irrational exuberance, but a continuation of a decades-long macroeconomic trend where labor share has been declining. Companies are doubling down on automation, which includes AI to maintain and even expand those profit margins. Examining the free cash flow-to-value ratio, as the research suggests, reveals this isn't a PE bubble inflating like the dot-com era.
Right, because traditional PE ratios haven't exactly been reliable predictors of mean reversion lately. But even if the cash flow is there now, isn't this whole thing a giant natural experiment, as Gura calls it? Are we just waiting to see if AI investment actually generates that future cash flow, or are we staring at a temporary distortion?
The data tells a story. It's a test of Heathcote's theory, essentially. Current valuations are supported by existing cash flows, but the shift to a capital-intensive AI phase introduces substantial uncertainty. The spending isn't outside historical norms overall, but its concentration in tech and the scale of it means the impact is magnified. If these investments don't deliver, the entire model shifts.
Speaking of magnified impact, Treasury Secretary Bessent, Jerome Powell, and Wall Street CEOs just had an emergency meeting about Anthropic's new model, Mythos. I mean, JP Morgan is already participating in Project Glasswing. That's not your typical regulator tech company check-in.
The urgency is noteworthy. Howell's participation especially signals that the cybersecurity risks surrounding AI are now a top regulatory concern. The speed and evolvability of AI-driven attacks represent a new paradigm. The fear is that regional banks, lacking the resources of a JP Morgan, will become vulnerabilities, creating a systemic shock.
So the bigger companies can afford to build the Glasswing, but everyone else is hoping for the best. This feels like a perfect setup for a widening chasm, and it loops back into the leadership problem. Executives are using AI daily, planning C-suite integration, while only 9% of workers trust it for complex tasks.
We can trace that further. That's the 64%-33% adoption gap. The anticipated spending is doubling, from $114 million to $207 million by Q1 2026, but it's not translating to ROI because of the lack of human enablement. The AI elite are getting promoted, others are being planned for layoff. The core issue isn't job security, the source material stresses its skills. 76% of employees lack the necessary skills.
Which brings us back to the sabotage. It's easier to quietly undermine a system you don't understand or trust. Now let's cut the jargon, human enablement is just training, right? And that's the 7% slice of the pie that's causing all this chaos.
Essentially, yes. The underinvestment in upskilling is a critical blind spot. The key takeaway here is the systemic risk isn't just technological, it's organizational and increasingly geopolitical. A workforce resistant to adoption, coupled with a concentrated cybersecurity threat landscape, could create significant instability.
Looking forward, if we assume this investment cycle continues, and the doubling of anticipated spending suggests it will, the most important thing to watch isn't the models themselves, but the distribution of wealth generated by them. Are we going to see a further consolidation of profits among a small number of companies, fueled by AI-driven automation, while the majority of the workforce falls behind? Because if we do, Project Glasswing isn't going to solve the problem. Looking back at everything, the sovereign debt overhang, the energy market pressures, this enormous AI buildout, it feels like we're not looking at three separate stories, but facets of a single, larger realignment. It's as if the system is sensing its own fragility and responding with a series of increasingly desperate and often contradictory actions. Jamie Dimon's description of private credit feels less like an isolated event and more like a canary in the coal mine.
There's a signal here. The core tension, as I see it, is one of resource allocation disguised as technological progress. We spoke about how $93 billion is flowing into AI infrastructure, with only 7% dedicated to human adaptation. That's not innovation, that's a preemptive restructuring of the labor market, and a bet on a future where the benefits are exceptionally concentrated. It's a pattern of prioritizing financial engineering over societal well-being. This isn't a tulip mania, but a systemic shift, reminiscent of how capital was redirected toward rail in the 19th century, but happening at warp speed.
And that's where the geopolitical instability comes in, isn't it? Matthew McLennan's bipolar hegemonic standoff isn't about nations vying for power, it's about competing approaches to managing a system under profound strain. If AI accelerates wealth consolidation, we can expect increasing social friction, and that's before factoring in the 44% of Gen Z actively sabotaging AI initiatives. It feels less like a technological uprising and more like a workforce intuitively resisting a future they don't believe benefits them.
I agree. And the energy markets are the pressure valve. The constrained oil production, roughly 1/6 of global supply, isn't just a supply issue. It's a reminder that real-world constraints, physical resources, still matter, and they can quickly expose the vulnerabilities of a purely financialized system. The 64%-33% adoption gap, trust in AI versus skepticism, that's a reflection of fundamental economic anxiety. As Sheets pointed out, earnings estimates are still trending upward, but for whom?
Which brings us back to investing. We talked about gold as defensive land, acquiring fixed positional assets in a world of fixed principal assets that are increasingly vulnerable. But even that feels insufficient. The idea of scarcity becomes paramount, but defining it beyond precious metals is the challenge. Are we talking about access to clean water, reliable energy, skilled labor? And what does that mean for the geopolitical landscape?
It's a natural experiment unfolding in real time. We're seeing the limits of traditional diversification, the disconnect between corporate narratives and worker realities, and the potential for governments to intervene, potentially with unpredictable consequences, as we discussed with Trump's rhetoric. It's like tasting a wine from a difficult vintage. You can detect the subtle shifts in acidity, the underlying tension, the potential for greatness or collapse. It's an unsettling but fascinating complexity.
So what do we watch? Continued macroeconomic turbulence, absolutely. Escalating geopolitical shocks as we anticipated. But the real story is the widening wealth gap and whether AI can deliver on its promises of productivity gains without exacerbating existing inequalities. and whether central banks truly grasp the scale of the energy price impact, particularly on those least able to absorb it.
And finally, the success or failure of these AI investments. If it's just about infrastructure, we're headed for a reckoning. If it truly unlocks new value, then we may see a more equitable outcome. But that's a very big if.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow to continue unpacking these complex issues.
Indeed. Until then, stay vigilant.